Now, I don't know if you've heard, but tomorrow's Labor Day. Breaking news. In addition, though, to a three-day weekend, it's important and significant to be mindful that Labor Day is about more than the symbolic end of summer. The first Monday in September is an invitation to remember and celebrate the labor movement's role in securing workers' rights in this country, even though there remains a lot more to do. In the late 19th century, an increasing number of states officially recognized Labor Day as a holiday, culminating in Congress declaring Labor Day a federal holiday in 1894. But I think it can be easy, at least for some of us, to forget just how much it is we owe to organized labor. As one bumper sticker says, labor unions, the folks who brought you the weekend, right? We could also add the folks who brought you child labor laws, overtime pay, minimum wage, injury protection, workers' compensation insurance, pension security, sick leave, safer working conditions, and more. All of these things, in many cases, had to, took blood and sweat and tears and loss of jobs and so much more to earn. And historically, many people used to spend 12 or more hours a day working for 6 or 7 days a week. But in the early 19th century and continuing for over 100 years, working hours in America were gradually ratcheted down, cut in half, according to most accounts. The labor movement pushed back against the exploitation of workers. And here's another oft-forgotten twist. If we rewound back to the late 19th century, extrapolating from the successes that had been seen of the labor movement up into the late 19th century, many of the best economists at the time regularly predicted, they were on the record, that by the end of the 20th century, a golden age of leisure would arrive. Is that what we all enjoy, a golden age of leisure? When no one would have to work more than 2 hours a day. For those forced to earn a living through alienated labor, working only 2 hours a day or 10 hours a week, that would mean time to actually pursue the American dream. The American dream, I think the propaganda's gotten confused, is not like getting a great job. And like the American dream is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? Instead of returning home too exhausted to do anything but try to rest a little bit before dragging oneself back to work the next day. That's the American nightmare that a lot of us are in. Labor activists did help secure, for most of us, a 5-day work week, and in some industries, even a 6-hour work day. But starting with the Great Depression in the 1930s, instead of continuing down to a 2-hour-a-day work week, this new emphasis arose on growing the economy through perpetually increasing consumer demand. So many of us find ourselves working increasingly long hours and having less free time to enjoy the fruits of our labors. So on this Labor Day weekend, I want to take us through a brief tour of the past, present, and future of the labor rights movement. To begin, I think that parable of the capitalist and the man relaxing on the beach that Danielle shared is a really profound touchstone for labor justice. And I asked her to tell it. So many of you know I come out of the Christian tradition, and I think one of the strengths of the Christian tradition is there's this kind of set of readings that you revisit and you get to know over time. And I think sometimes they go the other extreme and just stick to those and you never do anything new. We can be a little bit of a cult of novelty, that we're always doing something new. So I think it's good for us to revisit things from time to time, to have these touchstones that really ask us, just what are we working for? If the dream is relaxing with friends and family and hobbies, what if we just cut straight to doing a lot more of that? Well, part of the answer, of course, is that our current system is set up so that to even have the essentials to survive, of food and housing and health insurance, a lot of that's related to employment. Unless you have a vast amount of inherited wealth. But we may not be many years away from a future in which artificial intelligence and robots, as you've heard me say before, the immigrants aren't coming for your jobs, the robots are, right? In which AI and robots may be able to do a lot of the jobs that many of us currently do. So we really need to spend a lot of time considering how we might reimagine our relationship to work. As the journalist Sarah Yaffe has explored in her important book, Work Won't Love You Back. How might we imagine, you know, work's just not that into you. I don't know how to say it that way. How might we imagine a world of greater collective liberation with increasing numbers of people having more freedom and more joy? Now, more than 100 years ago, Marx expressed a similar sentiment this way. He said, "The realm of freedom really only begins when labor determined by necessity and external expediency ends." In other words, as a people, we say that we love freedom. We say we love freedom, but does the amount of time we spend at work belie that claim? At the same time, I'll confess that I work too much, as I know many of you do as well. But I also feel like I'm in a fairly privileged position, as some of you may be as well, of having a job that is highly aligned with my values, gives me quite a bit of freedom and a lot of joy as well. But it's important to acknowledge a lot of people don't particularly like your job. Some of you may identify with that as well. Some people hate, loathe their job, or even are massively exploited by their job on a regular basis, but have to keep working anyway to pay the bills. So let's spend just a little time reflecting on the history of the labor movement. How did things come to be the way they are in regard to our relationship to work? To do so, I'll be drawing on a powerful and accessible book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. I originally envisioned this sermon as kind of a top 10 list, and then I realized we'd be here at least 2 hours for me to get setting all that up. So this book is really good, though, if you're interested in learning more. Loomis is a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island. And I think mostly we do not do a very good job in our educational system of familiarizing people with the history of the movement for labor justice. It's just, and you've heard me say before, the stories we tell matter, right? The things we learn to kind of inscribe. And this book is a great resource. I'll barely scratch the surface of all he goes into. And the struggle for labor justice, it's taken a lot of forms over the years. Sometimes it looks like forming a union, or engaging in collective bargaining for workers' rights. Other times, it looks like just taking a couple of extra minutes on the break, you know, or checking social media on the job because you just don't care that much and because you feel underpaid and underappreciated and you're just carving out little corners for yourself. When looking back at U.S. history through the lens of labor justice, I think one of the most significant insights that pops out is that the Civil War can be clearly viewed as about workers' rights. I never really quite thought of it in that stark a way, but arguably the biggest labor strike in U.S. history took place during the Civil War, when the enslaved simply stopped working for their enslavers at the first opportunity. None other than W.E.B. Du Bois made this point in his landmark book, The Black Reconstruction in America. In his words, quote, "The Civil War was a general strike that involved directly perhaps 500,000 people. The enslaved wanted to stop the economy of the plantation system, and to do so, they left the plantation, and in some cases, joined the Union Army." This insight is a powerful way of weaving together the struggle for both racial and economic justice. Another powerful inflection point in the history of the labor movement coalesced around a song titled 8 Hours, whose chorus went like this. Oh, there's Black Reconstruction in America. I missed a slide. My apologies. It went like this. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, and 8 hours for what we will. I think these lyrics are a prime example of what can happen when we reimagine our collective relationship to work. Remember that question from Yaffe that we read earlier. How might we imagine a world in which increasing numbers of people have more freedom and more joy? Before this song, 8 hours, many people just took it for granted that it was natural and right to work 10 or 12 or 14 hours a day for 6 or 7 days a week. You know, 60 or 80 hour work week for low rate. It's one thing to work 60 or 80 hours if you're compensated at like a CEO level. It's another thing to do that when you're working, you know, barely getting by. This song helped capture the popular imagination that working as a huge percentage of your day is neither right nor fair. And it's an inspirational reminder that the movement for labor justice, it can be about far more radical changes than simply getting paid a little bit more, though that can be important too, don't get me wrong. So as we've explored, there have been tremendous paradigm shifts towards justice in the labor movement over time. Again, keep in mind all that's happened. Child labor laws didn't used to exist. Overtime pay didn't used to exist. Minimum wage, injury protection, workers' comp, pension security, sick leave, safer working conditions. But I need to be honest as well that reading about the history of the labor movement in our country, it's made me freshly aware that by and large, almost all the time, the U.S. government has sided with big business at the expense of workers, almost every time throughout our history. And as a child of the 80s, my own personal, you have to think about what's your own relationship to the labor rights movement. As a child of the 80s, my own coming to consciousness around labor rights was President Reagan's brutal betrayal of the air traffic controllers. Today, we live in a new gilded age with vast gaps in both income inequality and wealth inequality. And Professor Loomis says that from his own deep study of the labor rights movement, he would underscore three primary takeaways for those working for labor justice today. The first is, what do you need to start? The good news is that changes have almost always come. You know, you look at these 10 strikes in the history of America, they've always come from a small group of highly motivated people calling attention to some kind of labor inequality or injustice. When will we succeed? Now, here's the thing. It's almost impossible to predict when that small group will snowball into a larger movement, but it can happen very suddenly and unpredictably. And finally, how do we make reform stick for the long time? It almost always requires enough pro-labor politicians being elected to enact new laws. And we all know that in our current highly polarized political environment, doing what we need, something like a new Green Deal, is challenging, but there are some reasons for hope. According to Gallup polls, support for unions in the U.S. is up sharply over the past decade. So this is from 1940 to today, Americans' approval of labor unions. You can see them kind of high, going all kinds of places. But look on the right, that last 10 years, from 2010 to 2020, do you see this sharp spike upward? That's really notable. You have a slight downtick this past year. But it's still significant to note that even with a small downtick, two-thirds of Americans approve of unions. And there were two significant decisions you may have heard. I don't know how close you're following this. That's part of my inspiration for this sermon, is I want to seed some of the things currently happening in labor so that when you see them in passing, you'll maybe keep an eye on them. The National Labor Relations Board has just this month made two decisions to stop some of the most egregious ways that employers have prevented unions from being formed, such as preemptively firing that small group, those pro-labor employees. So in this environment in which the tide is turning, at least for now, a little bit in favor of labor justice, which has long been beleaguered, let's shift further into the present moment. I want to give you just four quick contemporary examples to keep your eyes on. First, it was heartening to see this recent win for UPS workers that averted a strike. Note that T-shirt that's a play on the UPS logo. It says pay up, right? So among their victories include both pay increases to keep up with inflation and getting rid of driver-facing cameras, also getting air conditioning in the vans, which is important. But those driver-facing cameras, do you want to be surveilled, you know, the entire time you're on? No one wants that, right? And relating, though, to what we said earlier about it being hard to predict when a small group will snowball into a mass movement, the most interesting thing is not just this victory for UPS workers, though that's significant. It's whether that UPS victory is going to inspire unionization at Amazon. Amazon is our country's second largest employer. The unionized UPS drivers now make $49 an hour. The non-unionized drivers at Amazon make $18 an hour. That's a difference of $31 an hour. Are you ready to sing Solidarity Forever? All right. That's a difference of more than $64,000 a year for doing the same work. Amazon also has an incredibly high level of employee surveillance. How many of you have seen the film Nomadland that came out about 3 years ago? All right, I see just a few hands. Really incredible film directed by Chloe Zhao, who's a really beautiful filmmaker, starring the always incredible Frances McDormand. She's always great. And it includes a significant subplot about her having a seasonal job at an Amazon warehouse. So I really recommend this film. Ironically, the best way to film it right now is through Amazon or Apple TV if you have that. So it is what it is. World's complicated. You're welcome, Jeff Bezos. Not really. All right, closer to home, just a few weeks ago, more than two-thirds of the faculty at Frederick Community College voted to form a union. Some of you will recall that this, you know, I don't know if this unionization effort wouldn't have happened, but it emerged out of a wave of protests that the previous president of the college was so, I don't think this is too, this is in the news post, she was so autocratic, she created a, quote, culture of fear on campus. And I think if that hadn't happened, I don't know if the votes would have been there to unionize. The hard truth is to get to the point of collective organizing, the situation sometimes, you know, to get bad enough that people are willing to give a percentage of their paycheck to pay into the union, right? Things have to get so bad that people get mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore, right? That's often what it takes. Also, the Hollywood strikes, right? To get things like Nomadland and new content, if you enjoy watching TV, relaxing in front of your streaming service of choice, follow what's happening with the Writers Actors Guild and the Screen Actors Guild. There will be no new good content until this is resolved. And this is also deeply around robots and AI, right? Whether writing is going to be done by AI, whether we've had a lot of films recently where like dead people are in actors or CGI created. I mean, it's not just writers, it's also actors. Also, back to UPS, whether deliveries are going to happen by drone, right? Whether they're going to be driverless cars. I mean, have y'all seen San Francisco has like hundreds of driverless cars, like right now in real time going, like all this is, the future's here. So we got to figure out how we're going to live well together with it. Finally, I'd be remiss if I failed to note that in less than 2 weeks, we could see a United Auto Workers strike at the big three automakers if contract negotiations fall through. So all this is to say that we live at a potential turning point in the history of labor, of the movement for labor justice, but there are no guarantees of how this will go. So as we each discern our own relationship to the labor movement and what we're called to do individually and collectively within our spheres of influence, it can be helpful to keep in mind that unless you are very rich, unless you have sufficient inherited wealth so that you do not need income, you are a worker. I think it's really important for all of us to identify with that identity of worker. The labor movement is vastly more likely to succeed when we widen the circle of those who see themselves as workers, needing to be in solidarity. We are stronger together. And that's one reason that Occupy Wall Street slogan was so important. We are the 99%. Together we can co-create a world, as our UU principles say, of peace, liberty, and justice. Not merely for some, not merely for the 1% who want to take, you know, the fruit of our labor and like go in SpaceX. Like that's what the 1% wants to do. It wants you to get very little money so they have money to go to space. You know, that's what they want. So we need peace, liberty, and justice, not merely for some, not merely for the 1%, but truly for all. So in that spirit, in a few moments, we'll be invited to sing Solidarity Forever. It's perhaps the labor movement's most famous anthem. The original lyrics were written in 1915. They were set to the tune of John Brown's Body. So keep that historical echo in mind. John Brown's Body was a marching song written decades earlier by Union soldiers during the Civil War about the radical abolitionist John Brown. Now, some of you may recall that of the Secret Six, so you know Harper's Ferry is just 20 minutes down the road, right? It's that way. Some of you may recall that of the Secret Six who helped fund and supply John Brown's 1859 raid on the Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry, of that Secret Six, five were Unitarians and two were Unitarian ministers. Among those five Unitarians was Samuel Howe, who was the husband of another of our Unitarian ancestors, Julia Ward Howe, who woke up in the middle of the night after visiting a Civil War camp and hospital and wrote new lyrics to the tune of John Brown's Body that became the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And that's the tune that we're going to be singing that's also Solidarity Forever. So when the Civil War began, you know, it was Julia's lyrics were quite influential in how the Civil War went. So as we prepare to sing this labor anthem, keep in mind, again, those historical echoes, John Brown's Body, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Note also that verse 4, this is all in your handout, is the women of the Union. So if you identify as female, sing on that verse. As we sing, may we open the imaginations of our minds and our hearts to what might become possible as we join together in solidarity with ever-widening circles of inclusion. Please rise. Let's sing together. Mm-hmm.